This is Audible.
We have everything we need to begin solving this crisis, with the possible exception of the will to act. But in America, our will to take action is itself a renewable resource.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents An Inconvenient Truth. The planetary emergency of global warming and what we can do about it. By Al Gore. Read by Beau Bridges, Cynthia Nixon, and Blair Underwood.
Some experiences are so intense while they're happening that time seems to stop altogether. When it begins again and our lives resume their normal course, those intense experiences remain vivid, refusing to stay in the past, remaining always and forever with us. 17 years ago, my youngest child was badly, almost fatally injured. This is a story I've told before, but its meaning for me continues to change and to deepen. That is also true of the story I've tried to tell for many years about the global environment. It was during that interlude 17 years ago when I started writing my first book, Earth and the Balance. It was because of my son's accident and the way it abruptly interrupted the flow of my days and hours that I began to rethink everything, especially what my priorities had been. Thankfully, my son has long since recovered completely, but it was during that traumatic period that I made at least 2 enduring changes. I vowed always to put my family first, and I also vowed to make the climate crisis the top priority of my professional life. Unfortunately, in the intervening years, time has not stood still for the global environment. The pace of destruction has worsened, and the urgent need for a response has grown more acute. The fundamental outline of the climate crisis story is much the same now as it was then. The relationship between human civilization and the Earth has been utterly transformed by a combination of factors, including the population explosion, the technological revolution, and a willingness to ignore the future consequences of our present actions. The underlying reality is that we are colliding with the planet's ecological system, and its most vulnerable components are crumbling as a result. I have learned much more about this issue over the years. I have read and listened to the world's leading scientists who have offered increasingly dire warnings. I have watched with growing concern as the crisis gathers strength even more rapidly than anyone expected. In every corner of the globe, on land and in water, in melting ice and disappearing snow, during heat waves and droughts, in the eyes of hurricanes and in the tears of refugees, the world is witnessing mounting and undeniable evidence that nature's cycles are profoundly changing. I've learned that beyond death and taxes, there's at least one absolutely indisputable fact. Not only does human-caused global warming exist, but it's also growing more and more dangerous, and at a pace that has now made it a planetary emergency. Less than a year after Earth in the Balance was published, I was elected vice president, ultimately serving for 8 years. I had the opportunity as a member of the Clinton-Gore administration to pursue an ambitious agenda of new policies addressing the climate crisis. At that time, I discovered firsthand how fiercely Congress would resist the changes we were urging them to make, and I watched with growing dismay as the opposition got much, much worse after the takeover of Congress in 1994 by the Republican Party and its newly aggressive conservative leaders. I organized and held countless events to spread public awareness about the climate crisis and to build more public support for congressional action. I also learned numerous lessons about the significant changes in recent decades in the nature and quality of America's conversation of democracy. Specifically, that entertainment values have transformed what we used to call news, and individuals with independent voices are routinely shut out of the public discourse. In 1997, I helped achieve a breakthrough at the negotiations in Kyoto, Japan, where the world drafted a groundbreaking treaty whose goal is to control global warming pollution. But then I came home and faced an uphill battle to gain support for the treaty in the U.S. Senate. In 2000, I ran for president. It was a hard-fought campaign that was ended by a 5-4 decision in the Supreme Court to halt the counting of votes in the key state of Florida. This was a hard blow. I then watched George W. Bush get sworn in as president. In his very first week in office, President Bush reversed a campaign pledge to regulate carbon dioxide emissions, a pledge that had helped persuade many voters that he was genuinely concerned about matters relating to the environment. Soon after the election, it became clear that the Bush-Cheney administration was determined to block any policies designed to help limit global warming pollution. They launched an all-out effort to roll back, weaken, and wherever possible, completely eliminate existing laws and regulations. Indeed, they even abandoned Bush's pre-election rhetoric about global warming, announcing that in the president's opinion, global warming wasn't a problem at all. As the new administration was getting underway, I had to begin making decisions about what I would do in my own life. After all, I was now out of a job. This certainly wasn't an easy time, but it did offer me the chance to make a fresh start, to step back and think about where I should direct my energies. I began teaching courses at 2 colleges in Tennessee, and along with Tipper, published 2 books about the American family. We moved to Nashville and bought a house less than an hour's drive from our farm in Carthage. I entered the business world and eventually started 2 new companies. I became an advisor to 2 already established major high-tech businesses. After the 2000 election, one of the things I decided to do was to start giving my slideshow on global warming again. I had first put it together at the same time I began writing Earth in the Balance, and over the years I've added to it and steadily improved it to the point where I think it makes a compelling case that humans are the cause of most of the global warming that is taking place, and that unless we take quick action, the consequences for our planetary home could become irreversible. For the last 6 years, I've been traveling around the world sharing the information I've compiled with anyone who would listen in colleges, small towns, and big cities. More and more, I've begun to feel that I am changing minds, but it is a slow process. In the spring of 2005, I gave my slideshow to a large gathering in Los Angeles, organized and hosted by environmental activist and film producer Laurie David, without whom the movie never would have been made. Afterward, she and Lawrence Bender, a veteran film producer who was essential to the project's success, first suggested that I ought to consider making a movie out of my presentation. I was skeptical because I couldn't see how my slideshow would translate to film. But they kept coming to other slideshows and brought Jeff Skoll, founder and CEO of Participant Productions, who expressed interest in backing the project. And then Scott Burns brought his unique and crucially important skills to the production team. Leslie Chilcott became the co-producer and legendary trail boss. Lawrence and Laurie also introduced me to the highly talented director, Davis Guggenheim. This extraordinary group convinced me that the translation of the slideshow into a film wouldn't need to sacrifice the central role of science for entertainment's sake. Davis Guggenheim's skills as a documentarian included an ability to ask probing questions during our many lengthy recorded dialogues. Questions that forced me to find new ways to articulate ideas and feelings that in some cases I had never put into words before. It was in response to one of his questions that I first used the phrase, "An Inconvenient Truth," a phrase that Davis later suggested be the title of the movie. I then chose that same title for this book. Tipper and I are, by the way, giving 100% of whatever profits come to us from the book and from the movie to a nonprofit bipartisan effort to move public opinion in the United States to support bold action to confront global warming. My hope is that those who hear these words, read the book, and see the film will begin to feel, as I have for a long time, that global warming is not just about science, and that it is not just a political issue. It is really a moral issue. Although it is true that politics at times must play a crucial role in solving this problem, this is the kind of challenge that ought to completely transcend partisanship. So whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, whether you voted for me or not, I very much hope that you will sense that my goal is to share with you both my passion for the earth and my deep sense of concern for its fate. It's impossible to feel one without the other when you know all the facts. I also want to convey my strong feeling that what we are facing is not just a cause for alarm. It is paradoxically also a cause for hope. As many know, the Chinese expression for crisis consists of two characters side by side. The first is the symbol for danger, the second, the symbol for opportunity. The climate crisis is indeed extremely dangerous. In fact, it's a true planetary emergency. 2,000 scientists in 100 countries working for more than 20 years in the most elaborate and well-organized scientific collaboration in the history of humankind have forged an exceptionally strong consensus that all the nations on Earth must work together to solve the crisis of global warming. What are the opportunities such a crisis also offers? They include not just new jobs and new profits, though there will be plenty of both. We can build clean engines, we can harness the sun and the wind, we can stop wasting energy, we can use our planet's plentiful coal resources without heating the planet. The procrastinators and deniers would have us believe this will be expensive. But in recent years, dozens of companies have cut emissions of heat-trapping gases while saving money. Some of the world's largest companies are moving aggressively to capture the enormous economic opportunities offered by a clean energy future. But there's something even more precious to be gained if we do the right thing. The climate crisis also offers us the chance to experience what very few generations in history have had the privilege of knowing, a generational mission, the exhilaration of a compelling moral purpose, a shared and unifying cause, the thrill of being forced by circumstances to put aside the pettiness and conflict that so often stifle the restless human need for transcendence, the opportunity to rise. When we do rise, it will fill our spirits and bind us together. Those who are now suffocating in cynicism and despair will be able to breathe freely. Those who are now suffering from a loss of meaning in their lives will find hope. When we rise, we will experience an epiphany as we discover that this crisis is not really about politics at all. It is a moral and spiritual challenge. At stake is the survival of our civilization and the habitability of the earth. The understanding we will gain about who we really are will give us the moral capacity to take on other related challenges that are also desperately in need of being redefined as moral imperatives with practical solutions. HIV/AIDS and other pandemics that are ravaging so many, global poverty, the ongoing redistribution of wealth globally from the poor to the wealthy, the ongoing genocide in Darfur, the ongoing famine in Niger and elsewhere, chronic civil wars, the destruction of ocean fisheries, families that don't function, communities that don't commune, the erosion of democracy in America, and the re-feudalization of the public forum. We should not fear this challenge. We should welcome it. We must not wait. In the words of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., tomorrow is today.
The first photograph that most of us ever saw of the Earth from space was taken on Christmas Eve, 1968, during the Apollo 8 mission. Apollo 8 was the first of the Apollo missions that left the confines of near-Earth orbit and circled the moon. It was scouting for landing sites before Apollo 11 touched down the following summer. The vessel went around the far side of the moon and lost radio contact, as expected. Inevitably, even though everyone understood the reason for the protracted silence, it was a time of great suspense. Then, as radio contact was reestablished, the crew looked up and saw a spectacular sight. The sunlit, blue and white half-globe of the planet Earth rising above the moon's gray horizon. While the crew watched the Earth emerging from the dark void of space, the mission commander, Frank Borman, read from the Book of Genesis. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. One of the astronauts aboard, a rookie named Bill Anders, snapped a picture, and it became known as Earthrise. The image exploded into the consciousness of humankind. In fact, within 2 years of the picture being taken, the modern environmental movement was born. The Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the National Environmental Policy Act, and the first Earth Day all came about within a few years of this picture being seen for the first time. The day after it was taken, on Christmas Day 1968, Archibald MacLeish wrote, "To see the Earth as it truly is, small and blue and beautiful in that eternal silence where it floats, is to see ourselves as riders on the earth together, brothers on that bright loveliness in the eternal cold, brothers who now know that they are truly brothers." MacLeish's words underscore a vital point. Many people today still assume, mistakenly, that the Earth is so big that we human beings cannot possibly have any major impact on the way our planet's ecological system operates. That assertion may have been true at one time, but it's not the case anymore. We have grown so numerous, and our technologies have become so powerful, that we are now capable of having a significant influence on many parts of the Earth's environment. The most vulnerable part of the Earth's ecological system is the atmosphere. It's vulnerable because it's so thin. The late Carl Sagan used to say, "If you had a globe covered with a coat of varnish, the thickness of that varnish would be about the same as the thickness of the Earth's atmosphere compared to the Earth itself." The atmosphere is thin enough that we are capable of changing its composition.
The Earth's atmosphere is so thin that we have the capacity to dramatically alter the concentration of some of its basic molecular components. In particular, we have vastly increased the amount of carbon dioxide, the most important of the so-called greenhouse gases. Stated in terms of basic science, global warming works like this. The sun's energy enters the atmosphere in the form of light waves and heats up the Earth. Some of that energy warms the Earth and then is re-radiated back into space in the form of infrared waves. Under normal conditions, a portion of the outgoing infrared radiation is naturally trapped by the atmosphere, and that is a good thing because it keeps the temperature on Earth within comfortable bounds. The greenhouse gases on Venus are so thick that its temperatures are far too hot for humans. The greenhouse gases surrounding Mars are almost non-existent, so the temperature there is far too cold. That's why the Earth is sometimes referred to as the Goldilocks planet. The temperatures here have been just right. The problem we now face is that this thin layer of atmosphere is being thickened by huge quantities of human-caused carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. And as it thickens, it traps a lot of the infrared radiation that would otherwise escape the atmosphere and continue out to the universe. As a result, the temperature of the Earth's atmosphere and oceans is getting dangerously warmer. That's what the climate crisis is all about. So what exactly are greenhouse gases? When we talk about greenhouse gases and climate change, carbon dioxide usually gets the most attention. But there are also some others, although carbon dioxide is the most important by far. What all greenhouse gases have in common is that they allow light from the sun to come into the atmosphere, but trap a portion of the outward-bound infrared radiation and warm up the air. Having some amount of greenhouse gases is beneficial. Without them, the average temperature of the Earth's surface would be right around 0 degrees Fahrenheit, not a very nice place to live. Greenhouse gases also help keep the Earth's surface at a much more hospitable average temperature, almost 59 degrees Fahrenheit. But due to increasing concentrations of human-caused greenhouse gases in modern times, We are raising the planet's average temperature and creating the dangerous changes in climate we all see around us. Carbon dioxide usually gets top billing in this because it accounts for 80% of total greenhouse gas emissions. When we burn fossil fuels, oil, natural gas, and coal, in our homes, cars, factories, and power plants, or when we cut or burn down forests, or when we produce cement, we release carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Like carbon dioxide, methane and nitrous oxide both predate our presence on the Earth but have gotten huge boosts from us. 60% of the methane currently in the atmosphere is produced by humans. It comes from landfills, livestock farming, fossil fuel burning, wastewater treatment, and other industry. In large-scale livestock farming, liquid manure is stored in massive tanks that emit methane. Dry manure, left on fields by contrast, does not. Nitrous oxide, another greenhouse culprit, also occurs naturally, though we have added 17% more of it to the atmosphere just in the course of our industrial age, from fertilizers, fossil fuels, and the burning of forests and crop residues. Sulfur hexafluoride, PFCs, and HFCs are all greenhouse gases that are produced exclusively by human activity. Not surprisingly, emissions of these gases are on the rise too. HFCs are used as substitutes for CFCs, which were banned because their emissions in refrigeration systems and elsewhere were destroying the ozone layer. CFCs were also very potent greenhouse gases. PFCs and sulfur hexafluoride are released into the atmosphere by industrial activities like aluminum smelting and semiconductor manufacturing, as well as the electricity grid that lights up our cities. And finally, water vapor is a natural greenhouse gas that increases in volume with warmer temperatures, thereby magnifying the impact of all artificial greenhouse gases.
Professor Roger Revelle was the first scientist to propose measuring carbon dioxide in the Earth's atmosphere. He and the scientist he hired to run the study, Charles David Keeling, began taking daily measurements in the middle of the Pacific Ocean over the Big Island of Hawaii in 1958. After the first few years, they had enough data to produce a graphic image of changes in atmospheric carbon dioxide. It was clear, even at this early stage of their experiment, that the concentration of carbon dioxide throughout the Earth's atmosphere was going up at a significant rate. The image on the graph, produced by Revelle and Keeling, was a jagged line rising steadily from left to right. The line goes sharply up, then down once each year, but the overall direction of the line is steadily upward. This annual rise and fall in carbon dioxide concentration happens because the vast majority of the Earth's landmass lies north of the equator. Likewise, the vast majority of the Earth's vegetation is also north of the equator. As a result, when the northern hemisphere is tilted toward the sun during the spring and summer, the leaves come out, and as they breathe in carbon dioxide, the amount of carbon dioxide decreases worldwide. When the northern hemisphere is tilted away from the sun in the fall and winter, the leaves fall, and as they disgorge carbon dioxide, the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere goes back up again. It's as if the entire Earth takes a big breath in and out once a year. The same pattern of steadily increasing concentrations of carbon dioxide that was visible after the first several years of Revelle's measurements has continued year by year for almost half a century. This remarkable and patiently collected daily record now stands as one of the most important series of measurements in the history of science. The pre-industrial concentration of CO2 was 280 parts per million. That was about 150 years ago. In 2005, that level, measured high above Mauna Loa, was 381 parts per million.
As a college undergraduate in the 1960s, I studied under Professor Roger Revelle, whose work we've just been talking about. As we mentioned, he was the first person to propose measuring carbon dioxide in the Earth's atmosphere. Revelle was a truly remarkable scientist, an imposing figure who seemed to possess an unusual air of authority, and always commanded respect from those who dealt with him. One reason for this may have been that my classmates and I knew that in addition to being a charismatic teacher, he was also first and foremost a hard-nosed scientist devoted to careful and methodical experimentation and patient analysis of the huge amounts of data he collected. In the 1950s, Revell formed what scientists call a hypothesis, but what seems to me to have been an almost prophetic insight. He saw clearly that the global post-World War II economic expansion, driven by explosive population growth and fueled mainly by coal and oil, was likely to produce an unprecedented and dangerous increase in the amount of carbon dioxide in the Earth's atmosphere. So he proposed and designed a bold new scientific experiment to collect samples of the carbon dioxide concentrations high in the Earth's atmosphere from multiple locations every day for many years into the future. Taking full advantage of the International Geophysical Year due to begin in 1957, Revell put together funding and hired a young researcher named Charles David Keeling. They established their principal research station at the top of Mauna Loa, the higher of the two massive volcanic mountains on the Big Island of Hawaii. They chose this spot in the middle of the Pacific Ocean because samples taken there would be untainted by local industrial emissions. A year later, they began launching weather balloons and painstakingly analyzing the amount of carbon dioxide in the air samples they collected each day. And after the first few years, the trend was already clear. By 1968, when I first walked into his natural sciences classroom, Professor Revell had become a professor at Harvard, and he shared with my classmates and me the results of the first several years of the carbon dioxide measurements at Mauna Loa. I'll never forget the graph he drew on the blackboard, nor the dramatic message it conveyed, that something profoundly new was happening to the atmosphere of the entire planet, and that this transformation was being caused by human beings. This was truly startling to me. If we could so quickly, significantly change the concentration of such an important atmospheric component everywhere in the world, then humankind was entering a new relationship with the Earth. Revell also expressed concern back then about the unprecedented absorption of carbon dioxide in the oceans as well as in the atmosphere. He saw early on that the world's oceans would bear a significant part of the burden of all that extra carbon dioxide released from burning fossil fuels. Only recently have rigorous new studies confirmed that Revell was right about that concern, too. The world's oceans are becoming more acidic due to the enormous quantities of carbon dioxide that produce carbonic acid and change the pH of the oceans, first in the colder waters near the poles, but soon, unless we change our ways quickly, throughout the entire ocean. Even though it was troubling, Professor Revell's logic all those years ago had the unmistakable ring of truth. It was obvious to our small group that he himself was surprised and disturbed by how quickly the carbon dioxide was building up. And more important, he understood and communicated forcefully to us what the likely implications of this data would turn out to be. He knew that this path our civilization had taken would send us careening toward catastrophe unless the trend could be reversed. Clearly, it was difficult for him to tell, and difficult for us to hear, this message that would later become, in our time, an inconvenient truth. I kept in touch with Professor Revell after I graduated, and I followed his steady, continuing measurements year after year. When I was elected to Congress to represent Tennessee's 4th Congressional District, I helped organize the first congressional hearing on global warming and invited Revell to be the lead-off witness. I really believed that my congressional colleagues on the committee would experience the same epiphany I had when they heard this great scientist's clear analysis. I couldn't have been more wrong. The urgency simply didn't come across. This surprised and disappointed me. I'd seriously underestimated the resistance and disinterest this alarming prognosis of global warming would meet. It wasn't the last time I would have that experience. I encountered a similar difficulty when I became a senator and chaired numerous hearings and science roundtables. I ran into it again when some of my colleagues and I failed to pass legislation to cap carbon dioxide emissions. I encountered it in 1987 and 1988 when I first ran for president, in part to gain more attention for this issue, and had great difficulty making it a central focus in the American political dialogue. I experienced it again as vice president when I tried to persuade Congress to pass bold measures to solve the climate crisis, and when I tried to convince the U.S. Senate to ratify the Kyoto Treaty that I helped to write. And I still run into it today. But I'm not done yet. I'm still trying to communicate the implications of the powerful truth first shown to me in that classroom by Roger Revelle. I'm only one of many students inspired by Revelle. Numerous scientists were as well. Most important among them was his research partner, Charles David Keeling, who was honored as a true scientific hero by his colleagues and our nation before his death in 2005. With extraordinary stamina, skill, and precision, Keeling faithfully and painstakingly measured the concentration of carbon dioxide in our world every day for almost half a century. Revelle died in 1991, before the world took action on his message. I saw him for the last time in San Diego not long before he died, and I still see his family from time to time. I miss him. He was a truly great man. My life has been changed by his prescient investigation, his wisdom, his dogged clarion call to pay attention to the solid scientific facts, and perhaps most of all, by his chart. I still show Revelle's chart of rising carbon dioxide levels many times each week. It's more elaborate now than when I first saw it. The Mauna Loa measurements now span 48 years. Moreover, with the information gleaned from ice cores drilled in Antarctica and Greenland, the chart has now been extended backward by 650,000 years, and with the help of modern supercomputers and sophisticated climate models, it can be projected many years ahead to measure the future impact of choices we are making today. It's a tribute to Roger Revelle's scientific brilliance that the essential core of the data we depend on to understand our changing planet is his. And it's a tribute to his wisdom that we are learning about the dangers we face while we still have time to put Earth's balance right again.
It is evident in the world around us that very dramatic changes are taking place. Mount Kilimanjaro in Tanzania is Africa's highest peak, nearly 6,000 meters or more than 19,000 feet above sea level. While it's not the world's highest mountain, it rises higher from its base than any other peak in the world, more than 15,000 feet. Its fabled snows and glaciers have captured human imaginations for centuries. Wide as all the world, Ernest Hemingway called them. Great, high, and unbelievably white in the sun. But Kilimanjaro's snow is disappearing, its glaciers rapidly receding. There is a message in this. Dr. Lonnie Thompson of Ohio State University is the world's leading expert on mountain glaciers. He predicts that within 10 years, there will be no more snows of Kilimanjaro. The same thing is happening here in the United States. Our own Glacier National Park in Montana will soon need to be renamed the park formerly known as Glacier. One of its massive glaciers, a tourist attraction in the 1930s, has disappeared completely. Scientists tell us that in 15 years, all of the glaciers throughout the park will likely be gone. Almost all of the mountain glaciers in the world are now melting, many of them quite rapidly. Alaska's Columbia Glacier in Prince William Sound has retreated some 12 kilometers since 1982 and has thinned drastically. Glaciers are shrinking throughout South America's Andes Mountains. The once vast Uppsala Glacier in Patagonia is now gone. Throughout the Alps in Europe, we are witnessing a similar story. The Chervas, Rosseg, and Rhone glaciers in Switzerland, the Adamolo Glacier in Italy, all greatly reduced or gone completely. The Himalayan glaciers on the Tibetan Plateau have been among the most affected by global warming. The Himalayas contain 100 times as much ice as the Alps and provide more than half of the drinking water for 40% of the world's population through 7 Asian river systems that all originate on the same plateau. Within the next half century, that 40% of the world's people may well face a very serious drinking water shortage unless the world acts boldly and quickly to mitigate global warming.
Scientist Lonnie Thompson takes his team to the tops of glaciers all over the world. They dig core drills down into the ice, extracting long cylinders filled with ice that was formed year by year over many centuries. Lonnie and his team of experts then examine the tiny bubbles of air trapped in the snow in the year that it fell. They can measure how much carbon dioxide was in the Earth's atmosphere in the past year by year. They can also measure the exact temperature of the atmosphere each year by calculating the ratio of different isotopes of oxygen, oxygen-16 and oxygen-18, which provides an ingenious and highly accurate thermometer. The team can count backward in time year by year, the same way an experienced forester can read tree rings by simply observing the clear line of demarcation that separates each year from the one preceding it. Dr. Thompson has created an image of thermometer readings measuring temperatures in the Northern Hemisphere over the past 1,000 years. It reveals a striking correlation between temperature and carbon dioxide concentrations during that time period as measured in the ice core record by Thompson's team. Nonetheless, the so-called global warming skeptics often say that global warming is really an illusion reflecting nature's cyclical fluctuations. To support their view, they frequently refer to the medieval warm period, a time in the 14th century when global temperatures increased by a small fraction of a degree. But Dr. Thompson's thermometer shows that the vaunted medieval warm period was tiny compared to the enormous increases in temperature of the last half century. Those global warming skeptics, a group diminishing almost as rapidly as the mountain glaciers, launched a fierce attack against another measurement of the 1,000-year correlation between carbon dioxide and temperature, known as the hockey stick, a graphic image representing the research of climate scientist Michael Mann and his colleagues. The name is derived from the sudden, recent upcurve in temperatures and carbon dioxide levels that result in a graph that looks like the outline of a hockey stick. But in fact, scientists have confirmed the same basic conclusions in multiple ways, with Thompson's ice core record as one of the most definitive. In Antarctica, measurements of carbon dioxide concentrations and temperatures go back 650,000 years. Once again, the two measurements run absolutely in parallel. It's a complicated relationship, but the most important part of it is this. When there is more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the temperature increases because more heat from the sun is trapped inside. At no point in the last 650,000 years before the pre-industrial era did the carbon dioxide concentration go above 300 parts per million. But now, the carbon dioxide is way above anything measured in the prior 650,000-year record. It's approaching 400 parts per million. And within 45 years, the carbon dioxide equivalent levels will be well over 600 parts per million if we do not make dramatic changes quickly. None of these facts, dates, or numbers are controversial. They are not disputed by anybody. To the extent that there is a controversy at all, it is that a few people in some of the less responsible coal, oil, and utility companies say, "So what? That's not going to cause any problem." But if we allow this to happen, it would be deeply and unforgivably immoral. It would condemn coming generations to a catastrophically diminished future.
Some events stay with you always and change the way you look at everything, no matter how many years go by. My son's serious accident when he was very young was that kind of event for me. It turned my life upside down and shook it until everything fell out. It was every parent's nightmare, and I'll never forget any part of it. It was a bright spring day in early April 1989. Tipper and I had taken our son to the season-opening Orioles game in Baltimore. We'd had a wonderful time, and as we left the stadium, my son's hand was in mine. Albert was just 6 and already loved baseball. We stopped at the curb with some neighbors after a long walk toward the lot where our car was parked. Suddenly, one of Albert's friends, who was walking just in front of us with his dad, bolted off the sidewalk and took off running as fast as he could across the busy one-way street, even though traffic was heading toward him from only half a block away. Then, in the next instant, with no warning, my son pulled his hand out of mine and jumped off the curb, running to chase his friend across the street. But just before he got to the far lane, he was hit by a speeding car. I watched what no parent should ever see. My son was knocked into the air with a horrible thud and then hit the pavement 30 feet away from the point of impact, scraping the pavement until he came to rest, motionless and silent. I don't know how many times I've relived those horrifying seconds, watching my precious child hurtle up and out of reach as I squeezed my fist tightly in a futile effort to hold the little hand that was already gone from mine. I've come to believe that we were literally in the company of angels that day. 2 off-duty nurses from Johns Hopkins Hospital, who'd also gone to the game, had brought their bags of emergency medical gear with them, just in case. And as I knelt by my son and prayed aloud, they appeared by his side and skillfully tended to him till the ambulance arrived. Waiting to hear that rescue siren was the most excruciating 6 minutes of my life. Tipper and I both knelt next to Albert, holding on to him, talking to him, and praying. I've never felt so desperate or so helpless. Albert's life was saved by those nurses on the street and by the doctors and nurses at nearby Johns Hopkins Hospital, where he was quickly taken by the ambulance. He had suffered a concussion, a broken collarbone, broken ribs, a compound fracture of his thigh bone, and massive internal injuries, including a ruptured spleen, most of which had to be removed the following day, as well as a bruised lung and pancreas and a fractured kidney. He had second-degree burns where he'd skidded on the concrete and damage to the large cluster of nerves that ran down from the spinal cord through the shoulder to his right arm, causing him to lose the use of his right arm entirely for almost a year. Tipper and I lived at the hospital for a month, and finally, blessedly, Albert came home in a full body cast. After months of rehabilitation with our 3 daughters helping around the clock, even taking turns relieving us in the middle of the night when Albert had to be manually turned in his bed, he recovered. And within a year, he was completely healed and back to full strength in every way. I tell this story because it was a turning point that changed me in ways I couldn't have imagined. And even though it's hard to describe in words the linkage between the searing pain of this event and the new outlook I'd formed on what is really important, inside me it is there, always. Suddenly the events that packed my schedule, once so seemingly urgent, were revealed as truly insignificant. I realized how trivial those events were that a month earlier it seemed so weighty, and began looking at my whole life through the same new lens. I asked myself, how did I really want to spend my time on Earth? What really matters? For me, the first answer was my family, my wife and my children. I made immediate changes to prioritize time with them, each one of them individually, and all of us as a family together, in a way I had not done before. I subordinated everything else in my schedule and weekly routine to put time with them first. Quality time, and ample time. I also reevaluated the nature of my public service. I questioned what it really means to serve. The environment had for years been at the forefront of my policy concerns, but it had been competing for attention with a lot of other issues. Now, in this comprehensive and soul-searching rethinking of how I would spend my time, the global environment trumped all other concerns. I realized this was the crisis that loomed largest and should occupy the bulk of my efforts and ingenuity. It was during Albert's recovery that I started writing my first book, Earth in the Balance. It was then that I started putting together the first version of the slideshow. Not only was it a way to warn my fellow Americans of the spiraling disaster to which we are all, wittingly or not, contributing, it was also a way to put my own priorities in order. I would give anything to redo that awful day long ago, to glue my young boy's hand to my own, to miss that Orioles game entirely. But I know I can't. I feel so grateful for the healing and grace that was given to him and to our family. A child acts on impulse, and suddenly his parent cannot protect him. Sometimes the worst does happen. We were lucky enough to get a reprieve that afternoon. We have been blessed with 4 healthy, wonderful, thriving, grown children, and now we dote on our own grandchildren. But I truly believe I was handed not just a second chance, but an obligation to pay attention to what matters, and to do my part to protect and safeguard it, and to do whatever I can at this moment of danger to try to make sure that what is most precious about God's beautiful earth, its livability for us, our children, future generations, doesn't slip from our hands.
Since the Civil War, that is, since the industrial era began, global temperatures have been steadily increasing. In any given year, it might seem as if the average global temperature is going down, but the overall trend is very clear. And in recent years, the rate of increase has been accelerating. In fact, 20 of the 21 hottest years on record have occurred within the last 25 years. The hottest year recorded during this entire period was 2005. We have already begun to see the kind of heat waves that scientists say will become much more common if global warming is not addressed. In the summer of 2003, Europe was hit by a massive heat wave that killed 35,000 people. In the summer of 2005, many cities in the American West broke all-time records for high temperatures and for the number of consecutive days with temperatures of 100 degrees Fahrenheit or more. Reno, Nevada set a new record for most consecutive days at 100 degrees or hotter, 10 days. On July 19, 2005, Las Vegas, Nevada hit 117 degrees, tying its all-time high. On July 21, 2005, Grand Junction, Colorado hit 106 degrees, setting a new all-time high. Tucson, Arizona tied its record for the most consecutive days at 100 degrees or higher, 39 days. On July 20th, 2005, Denver, Colorado hit 105 degrees, tying its all-time high. In all, more than 200 cities and towns in the West set all-time records. And in the East, a number of cities set daily temperature records, including, significantly, New Orleans. On June 23rd, 2005, La Crosse, Wisconsin hit 98 degrees, a new daily high. On July 27, 2005, Newark, New Jersey hit 101, a new high for that date. On July 26, 2005, Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina hit 101. On July 26, 2005, Florence, South Carolina hit 101. On July 25, 2005, the Louis Armstrong Airport in New Orleans, Louisiana hit 98 degrees. These temperature increases are taking place all over the world, including in our oceans. Many people say about the rising temperatures, oh, it's just natural variability. Things go up and down, so we shouldn't worry. And indeed, there is always a lot of variability in temperatures, and that's true in oceans as well. We can chart the range of normal, natural variability in ocean temperatures. But scientists who specialize in global warming have been using ever more accurate computer models that long ago predicted a much higher range of ocean temperatures as a result of man-made global warming. What the computers told us would happen as a result of climate change is that ocean temperatures would begin to diverge from the boundaries of natural variability in the mid-1970s. And now we can chart what the actual ocean temperatures have been. Temperatures have been painstakingly compiled from measurements of all the world's oceans taken over the past 60 years. They are rapidly rising. In fact, the actual ocean temperatures are completely consistent with what has been predicted as a result of man-made global warming, and they're way above the range of natural variability. As the oceans get warmer, storms get stronger. In 2004, Florida was hit by 4 unusually powerful hurricanes. A growing number of new scientific studies are confirming that warmer water in the top layer of the ocean can drive more convection energy to fuel more powerful hurricanes. There is less agreement among scientists about the relationship between the total number of hurricanes each year and global warming, because a multi-decade natural pattern has a powerful influence on hurricane frequency. But there is now a strong, new emerging consensus that global warming is indeed linked to a significant increase in both the duration and intensity of hurricanes. Brand new evidence is causing some scientists to assert that global warming is even leading to an increased frequency of hurricanes, overwhelming the variability in frequency long understood to be part of natural deep current cycles. As the United States was being hit by numerous large hurricanes in 2004, Japan's weather did not get as much attention in the Western media. Yet that same year, Japan set an all-time record for typhoons. The previous record was 7. In 2004, 10 typhoons hit Japan. Typhoons, hurricanes, and cyclones are all the same weather phenomena, depending on the ocean in which they originate. In the spring of 2006, Australia was hit by several unusually strong Category 5 cyclones, including Cyclone Monica, the strongest cyclone ever measured off the coast of Australia, stronger than hurricanes Katrina, Rita, or Wilma. The science textbooks had to be rewritten in 2004. They used to say, it's impossible to have hurricanes in the South Atlantic. But that year, for the first time ever, a hurricane hit Brazil. Also in 2004, the all-time record for tornadoes in the United States was broken. Hard on the heels of 2004 came the record-breaking summer of 2005. Several hurricanes hit the Caribbean and the Gulf of Mexico early in the season, including Hurricane Dennis and Hurricane Emily, which caused significant damage. The emerging consensus linking global warming to the increasingly destructive power of hurricanes has been based in part on research showing a significant increase in the number of Category 4 and 5 hurricanes. A separate study predicts that global warming will increase the strength of the average hurricane a full half step on the well-known 5-step scale. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration summarized some of the basic elements common to these new research studies in a graph. The graph illustrates that as water temperatures go up, wind velocity goes up, and so does storm moisture condensation. Hurricane Dennis hit the Gulf of Mexico on July 11, 2005. It severely damaged the largest oil platform in the world, BP's Thunder Horse platform, 150 miles southeast of New Orleans. In April 2006, one-third of the Gulf's oil-producing facilities, including Thunder Horse, remained crippled. Late in the 2005 hurricane season, a 13,000-ton oil platform was driven into a bridge in Mobile, Alabama. On July 31, 2005, less than a month before Hurricane Katrina hit the United States, a major study from MIT supported the scientific consensus that global warming is making hurricanes more powerful and more destructive. The report concluded that major storms spinning in both the Atlantic and the Pacific since the 1970s have increased in duration and intensity by about 50%. And then came Katrina. When it first hit Florida on its way into the Gulf on the morning of August 26, 2005, it was only a Category 1 storm, but it killed a dozen people and caused billions of dollars in damage. Then it passed over the unusually warm waters of the Gulf of Mexico. By the time Katrina hit New Orleans, it was a massive and powerfully destructive storm. The consequences were horrendous. There are no words to describe them.
There was a storm in the 1930s of a different kind, a horrible, unprecedented gathering storm in continental Europe. Winston Churchill warned the people of England that this was different from anything that had ever happened before and told them they needed to prepare for it. There were many who did not want to believe his warning, and he became impatient with their dithering, and he said this: "The era of procrastination, of half-measures, of soothing and baffling expedients, of delays, is coming to its close. In its place, we are entering a period of consequences." Just 3 weeks after Katrina, another hurricane that reached Category 5 strength, Rita, hit the U.S. coast not too far west of Katrina's landfall. This time, it hit less populated areas, though the damage and suffering it caused were still devastating. Then, just a few weeks after Rita, Hurricane Wilma became, while still out at sea, the strongest hurricane ever measured. It traveled back eastward from Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula to southern Florida, causing massive damage and leaving thousands without water or electricity for weeks. And before Wilma left the scene, something new happened. We ran out of names. For the first time in history, the World Meteorological Organization had to start using the letters of the Greek alphabet to name the hurricanes and tropical storms that continued on into December, well past the end of the 2005 hurricane season. Warmer water increases the moisture content of storms, and warmer air holds more moisture. When storm conditions trigger a downpour, more of it falls in the form of big, one-time rainfalls and snowfalls. Partly as a result, the number of large flood events has increased decade by decade on every continent. In many areas of the world, global warming also increases the percentage of annual precipitation that falls as rain instead of snow, which has led to more flooding in spring and early summer. In 2005, Europe had a year of unusual catastrophes, very similar to the one in the United States. While the United States was ending a seemingly unprecedented string of large hurricanes in 2005, Europe was experiencing a disastrous number of floods. United Press International summarized the feelings of many Europeans on August 26, 2005, when it reported, "Nature is going crazy in Europe." Flooding in Asia has also increased dramatically. In July 2005, Mumbai, India received 37 inches of rain in 24 hours. It was by far the largest downpour that any city in India has ever received in one day. Water levels reached 7 feet. The death toll in western India reached 1,000. There's also been record flooding in China, which, as one of the planet's oldest civilizations, keeps the best flood records of any nation in the world. Paradoxically, however, global warming causes not only more flooding, but also more drought. Anhui Province in China was suffering a severe drought at the same time the neighboring areas were flooding. One of the reasons for this paradox has to do with the fact that global warming not only increases precipitation worldwide, but at the same time causes some of it to relocate. Overall, the amount of precipitation has increased globally in the last century by almost 20%. However, the effects of climate change on precipitation are not uniform. Precipitation in the 20th century increased overall, as expected with global warming, but in some regions, precipitation actually decreased. Sometimes the effects of such a large shift can be devastating. Unbelievable tragedies have been unfolding in the part of Africa that includes southern Sudan to the east of Lake Chad, where genocidal murders have become commonplace in the region of Darfur. In Niger, just to the west of Lake Chad, the region-wide drought